This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Area News. Important stories that impact your life do not always happen in the metro area. Keep up with the news happening all around you and in your neighborhood, no matter where you live. For the next 60 minutes, it's Area News, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Area News, and I'm your reader, Alexander, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from The Decatur Daily Democrat, The Post and Mail, Plain Dealer, The Wayndale News, and KPC. And now I'll be starting with the Saturday, May 4th, 2024 issue of the Post and Mail, with the article, Downtown Cleanup Day Sees Growth in Participation. From Staff Reports, Columbia City. Downtown Columbia witnessed a remarkable display of community spirit during this year's Downtown Cleanup Day, spearheaded and organized by Columbia City Connect. Engaging enthusiastic volunteers from all walks of life, the event saw individuals and groups banding together to beautify downtown. Reflecting on the success of the initiative, which has grown in 3 years from 7 to 40 volunteers, Nikki Keister, Executive Director of Columbia City Connect, expressed her excitement, saying, "Downtown Cleanup Day is gaining momentum. A growing event like this can make a significant impact on the downtown's overall atmosphere, and we are thrilled to be a part of it. Such events extend beyond mere cleanliness. They foster a profound sense of community pride and involvement. With increased participation and support, the transformative potential becomes even more evident, enriching the downtown experience for residents and visitors alike." Kayla Wygent, a board member of Columbia City Connect, shared her admiration, saying, "We are so impressed with the commitment from the community to improving and maintaining the downtown area. The unwavering dedication of community members to enhance and preserve their downtown area is truly commendable. Witnessing individuals unite with a common purpose to elevate their surroundings underscores the vibrant spirit of Columbia City. The collective efforts of the Columbia City Connect Board, alongside volunteers and participants, stand as a testament to the positive impact they are affecting on their town." For more information about Columbia City Connect and upcoming community events, visit ColumbiaCityConnect.com. Next up, we have the article, "Education Student from Columbia City is Recognized." From Staff Reports, Kokomo. 36 future educators, including one from Columbia City, were welcomed to the profession during the Indiana University Kokomo School of Education's annual recognition ceremony. Annual recognition ceremony Wednesday in Havens Auditorium. Dylan Weaver, earning his bachelor's degree in secondary education and political science, called the night an excellent feeling. "All the hard work we've put in over the past 4 years has really come to a head," he said. "I think that they, School of Education, put us in situations and gave us opportunities that prepare us for the real world." Allison Davis Williams, who previously received her bachelor's degree in fine arts, was recognized as a part of the School of Education's transition to teaching program, which helps those who have already earned their bachelor's degree make the move into working in education. "I knew that I wanted to do teaching all along, but I did it the hard way," Davis Williams said. What inspired her, she added, were her past teachers. "Seeing the fun, new things they were doing with their students inspired me to become a teacher myself." In his address, Scott Jones, Executive Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, welcomed students and their guests, and told stories of his mother, a retired first-grade teacher, who is still greeted in public by her former students. These are not her stories or my stories, he said. These are stories that will be about you. These are the same sort of experiences and differences you can make in people's lives. Christopher Darr, interim dean of the School of Education, echoed Jones, adding, "You are entering a special profession. The point of education is to change lives by empowering young people," Darr said. "There can be nothing nobler." Tara Kokanoer, Indiana's 2023 Teacher of the Year and a teacher at Bluffton High School, encouraged graduates to make their own definition of a great teacher. "I think the world thinks that they understand what we do, what we're about, what teachers are capable of, but they have no idea," Kokanoer said. "If you think about what makes a great teacher, it's whatever you want it to be. You can create that narrative." The School of Education also recognized senior Clarissa Vasquez for her exemplary achievements, naming her the outstanding student in elementary education. In her speech, Vasquez called on her fellow graduates to carry a light of knowledge and kindness into their classrooms. "Teaching is not merely imparting knowledge, but about molding futures," she said. "We hold so much power for change. Embrace the challenges, celebrate each victory, and continue to inspire curiosity and a love of learning in your students." Honorees are listed by degree and hometown. They are Elementary Education and Early Childhood, Bunker Hill, Alyssa Mastin, Flora, Gabrielle Fewell, Frankfurt, Nally Alanis, Kokomo, Joel Barnes, Stephanie Edwards, Chanel Majors, Lafayette, Yoselin Kwatlati Tepehua, Logansport, Addison Brown, Peru, Grace Tubb, Russiaville, Kayla Drosch, Sheridan, Mikaeli Kinkade, Swayze, Jennifer Dowling, Winema, Shalin Day. Elementary Education and Special Education, Columbia City, Anna Marie Yeager, Jonesboro, Ali Alcala, Lafayette, Cassie Dispinette, Noblesville, Mackenzie Pedigo, Peru, Mackenzie Wentz, Gwendolyn Werner, Sharpsville, Kylie Fernung, Westfield, Brooke Lawrence. Elementary Education and Psychology, Greentown, Aaliyah Behrens, Clarissa Vasquez, Kokomo, Maria Duggar, Abigail Williams, Logansport, Erica Cerna, Marion, Christopher Weaver, Peru, Sydney Berry, Rochester, Kennedy Musselman. Secondary Education and Social Studies, Kokomo, Hannah Sandifer, Rochester, Dylan Weaver. Secondary Education and English, Logansport, Leslie Alcala. Secondary Education and Visual Arts, Noblesville, Kobe Woodring, Peru, Medora Ulrich, Sharpsville, Parker Sayers. Transition to Teaching, Kokomo, Allison Davis Williams. Indiana Association of Colleges for Teacher Education Outstanding Future Educator Award, Brooke Lawrence, Parker Sayers, Kobe Woodring. School of Education Outstanding Elementary Education Student, Clarissa Vasquez. School of Education Outstanding Secondary Education Student, Dominguez. Next up, we have the article, $5 million awarded to expand child care services in region to aid workforce. Program to keep graduates in area also funded. This article by Lisa Esquivel-Long. Fort Wayne. The Northeast Indiana Strategic Development Commission has designated $5 million for a regional child care program to design to designed to alleviate one burden, preventing parents from being in the workforce. The group also set aside $110,000 to expand a program designed to keep college graduates working in the region. Allie Sutherland, Northeast Indiana Early Childhood Coalition, explained how nearly 39,000 children under the age of 6 in the region need care. However, only 16,350 total spaces are available. To meet the need, the region needs to increase its capacity 6% annually over the next 10 years. However, in 2023, the region lost 352 seats, and we continue to close facilities, Sutherland said. We know that with three barriers that we're really facing, Sutherland said. Affordability, average cost of care for a family is $12,000 for an infant, a family of four, $21,000 for an infant and a four-year-old. The group did an economic impact study in 2022 that found 9,000 work-willing families in the region, those willing to return to work if they had affordable child care. The group also found a need for economic assistance for families, which is cut off at the 150% of federal poverty level. So the family of four paying $21,000 for child care can't make more than $46,000, she said. Another barrier is child care facility capacity. The region has licensed capacity to serve 42% of the children who need care now, she said. Looking at quality seats, that figure is even lower. We know that this is impacting our labor force, local taxes generated, employers' ability to hire, and overall our economic viability, Sutherland said. One thing not often discussed is the challenges faced by childcare organizations. This is a labor-dependent industry with limits of how many children can be served, she said. And so the only way to increase revenues for childcare providers is to increase tuition for families. Childcare facilities know that they can't do that right now because families can't afford it. So they're operating at deficits and childcare seats are lost, Sutherland said. NIECC will use the money for its TriShare Plus program, which is twofold. First, it provides financial aid to working families throughout the 11-county region. Second, it will help childcare organizations so they can provide the space and staff needed to serve more children. On April 23rd, the commission received word that the State of Indiana Budget Committee voted to approve a $30 million grant for the regional group's work. It was created by the Indiana General Assembly in 2021 to create a five-year plan for 2023-28 to grow population, wages, and credential attainment in the 11-county region of Northeast Indiana. Adams, Allen, DeKalb, Huntington, Kosciusko, LaGrange, Noble, Steuben, Wabash, Wells, and Whitley. Commission member Steve McMichael, mayor of New Haven, had reservations about NIECC requesting over 16% of the commission's total funding. Fellow member Richard Strick, mayor of the city of Huntington and chair of the Education Subcommittee, noted that the group was asked to request what it believed was needed to make the program a success, and it had already pulled back on the figure from $8 million. After discussion, McMichael said he was 100% in favor of granting the request. No members voted against the ask. Liz Bushnell of Cuesta made a request for the group of $110,000 to recruit traditional and non-traditional college students from out of state, particularly engineering students, to bolster the region's manufacturing industry. The Don Wood Foundation has promised a match of $440,000 for the program. That will enable us to fund at least 25 students over the next couple of years, she said. Cuesta uses a college debt forgiveness program for graduates who stay and work in the region for 5 years. A bachelor's degree graduate can receive up to $20,000 in aid. They'll get 75% of their loan forgiven, with another 25% if they go to a partner college. Questa gets back 50% of the investment. It's seeing a 78% retention rate. The commission voted to grant the request. The commission has tentatively scheduled a housing forum for September 12th at Purdue Fort Wayne and will use $3,900 of the $50,000 allotted to the housing subcommittee to employ sand strategies to organize the event. Sharon Tucker, the only woman on the commission, was congratulated by her fellow members as the new mayor of Fort Wayne. She was appointed to the group while serving the 6th District on Fort Wayne City Council. She was chosen April 20th to replace the late Mayor Tom Henry in a Democratic Party caucus. The commission will next meet at 3 p.m. May 24th. For more information, for more on the commission and its work, see neisdc.org. Next up, from the Thursday, May 2nd, 2024 edition of the Decatur Daily Democrat, we have the article, Renovate Counseling to Open Office in Decatur. Renovate Counseling Services, LLC, a mental health counseling center that seeks to provide services to individuals, couples, and families in Northeast and Central Indiana areas, has announced plans to open an office in Decatur this month. The Decatur office will be located at 915 South 11th Street, and the direct office number there is 260-301-3155. Renovate Counseling Services functions as a traditional private practice medical mental health counseling center in that counseling is offered by qualified and licensed master's-level counselors and social workers through face-to-face and telehealth channels. Renovate Counseling accepts all forms of commercial insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and has low-cost options for individuals without insurance. Renovate Counseling Services is non-traditional in that it seeks to function first as a ministry to the community. To that end, Renovate Counseling believes in providing excellent services at affordable prices that puts families, couples, and individual clients first. Lane Sander, MA/MDIV/LMHC, is the director and founder of Renovate Counseling Services, founded in 2016, and is a licensed mental health counselor in the state of Indiana. 7 years ago, he was the only counselor serving the Bluffton area. At present, Renovate now has 20 therapists across its footprint, with locations in Bluffton, Huntington, Shelbyville, and this May is opening a new location in Decatur. John Lees, LMHC, will be joining the Decatur site supervisor. Joining him will be Alicia Silver Wallace, LMHCA, LPC, LICDC, Briar Stuckey, LMHCA, and Maddie Teeter, LMHCA. Renovate Counseling Services addresses the following areas of counseling: depression, anxiety, addictions, marriage/couples, premarital, family, grief, and trauma counseling. For more information or to schedule at one of the offices, persons may call 260-307-5030. Next up, we have the article, CPR Revives Child Taken from Pond. Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation, CPR, Works. An unnamed, rural Adams County family is very thankful for that fact today, after it was discovered a 2-year-old child had entered a pond located at 5940 S-200 West, Bern, shortly after 1 p.m. Tuesday, according to the Adams County Sheriff's Department log. Adams County Sheriff Dan Maurer reported the child's father quickly entered the water, removed the child, and placed the child on the ground where he started to perform CPR. While deputies from the Adams County Sheriff's Department, officers from the Bern Police Department, and Adams County EMS medics were on their way to the scene, the child responded to the prompt life-saving technique delivered by the father and woke up. By the time medics and police officers arrived, the child was awake and crying. I'll take that type of crying any day in that type of situation, Mowar said. Due to the situation, EMS still went ahead and transported the child to the hospital for a full medical evaluation. Privacy laws prohibited the hospital from commenting on the child's condition. Next up, we have the article, State Seeking Public Comment on Proposed Deer Hunting Rules. Indiana's Natural Resources Commission, NRC, has opened a second public comment period for proposed changes to Indiana's deer hunting rules before it votes on final adoption of the proposed changes. Most proposed changes intend to simplify Indiana's deer hunting rules to make them easier to understand. Public comments can be submitted online at in.gov/nrc/rules/rulemaking docket via the Submit Comments Here link in the rulemaking docket for the deer hunting amendments. Comments can also be mailed to Natural Resources Commission, Indiana Government Center North, 100 North Senate Avenue, Room N103, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46204. The deadline for submitting public comments is May 20th. Proposed changes include a statewide bag limit of 6 antlerless deer, as well as a newly created county antlerless bag limit instead of season antlerless bag limits. Because of this change, the bonus antlerless license would be the multiple season antlerless license that could be used in the archery, muzzleloader, and firearm seasons. Hunters would not be able to harvest an antlerless deer on fish and wildlife properties with a firearm. The use of crossbow equipment would be allowed under the archery license. The minimum caliber for a muzzleloader would be reduced from 0.44 inches to 0.40 inches. If a deer is unfit for human consumption, DNR staff would be able to issue an authorization to take an antlerless deer in its place that will not count toward the statewide bag limit or county limit. Adding the deer reduction zones and county antlerless bag limits. Removing the special antlerless firearm season. For more information on the proposed changes, visit the wildlife.in.gov website. Questions about the proposed deer regulation changes should be directed to 812-334-3795 or IN Deer Hotline at dnr.in.gov. Next up, we're moving on to Plain Dealer, the Thursday, April 25th, 2024 edition. Solar, with the article, Solar on the Fringe of Huntington County. This article by Eileen Haluska. Huntington. Huntington County's solar agenda was put on hold Monday during the Board of County Commissioners meeting after at least 150 people turned out for the discussion and hearing more than five people speak. The commissioners' next steps include meeting with residents for a solution to their concerns. Nobody knew nothing about this since a month ago, said Terry Stoffel, Board of Commissioners Vice President after the meeting. He believes in people's property rights and how it's going to affect the residents. I'm here representing those people, Stoffel said. There's already zoning in place, according to Tom Wall, president of the board. We're having our attorney look it over to look at what our process is, and if our process is coming up with a list of things to send that back to the Plan Commission, then we will and put a moratorium on it, and if we put it out to vote, as a question to the residents, Wall said, adding later that no one seemed against solar, but want their concerns resolved. We've got to consider what's best for the whole county, added Commissioner Rob Miller. One resident speaker who lives in the area and owns a business, not a farm, explained that people didn't know about the ordinance. He doesn't think his taxes should pay for something he has nothing to do with. The agriculture aspect to solar farming should be in an industrial commercial ordinance, not a local one under the guise of agriculture, according to Huntington County resident Bob Bullen of Union Township. Representing Genex Solar LLC, Trina Rudebush explained later in the meeting that that solar panels are built tough like a car's windshield in case of storm issues like hail. And the Union Township area has the existing infrastructure, landowners choosing to lease parts of their property, and the business community support of renewable energy. EDF Renewables is developing in Huntington County for three key reasons. First, available capacity on the existing transmission infrastructure. Second, landowners who have chosen to lease portions of their land into an energy project. And finally, the desire of businesses to locate near sources of renewable energy, Rudebush said. We look forward to continuing our work with neighbors and community leaders as we make a long-term investment in Huntington County. With our Paddlefish Solar Project, EDF Renewables committed to establish a $500,000 fund that will issue individualized electricity credit to 49 adjacent neighbors of the project across Huntington and Wells over the first 15 years of project's operations, Rudebush said, adding that it's in a county revitalization area, mostly in Wells County. Another project, Bofin, under development is in Huntington County. One farm of 2,000 acres is in a floodplain, explained its owners Justin and Laura Hosler of Union Township. They explained that they were approached about the venture and declined. When it rains even 2 inches, their land is underwater, and questioned how that would impact solar energy and their farm. Laura added that the solar equipment goes 10 feet deep into the ground. The organization reportedly has farms signed up totaling 3,600 acres and wants to get 5,000 acres for the project, Hosler said, which is a large amount of land and crosses over into Wells County. Rudebush explained that Paddlefish will have about 1,700 acres within the fence. About 3,000 were part of lease agreements, which is typical. Another comment that came up extended to the state level, where legislation says farmers planting corn, wheat, and soybeans pay less taxes on an assessed value per acre versus a higher tax valuation for a solar farm acre. Additionally, people are discouraged in using less fossil fuels and encouraged to use other forms of energy, for example, from solar and wind. Issues residents want addressed are health concerns, noise pollution of humming panels, drainage or water displacement, setbacks from others' property, traffic while installing, fire issues as to who would be responsible to pay to train firefighters to work a solar farm fire, cell phone disruption. Farmers are making the commitment to have their land turned into a solar farm. Solar farms draw lightning during storms, an abatement for the solar contractors for the equipment only. Subcontractors bring in employees without background checks. What is the alternative to renewable energy? And residents who've relocated or retired to Huntington County because of the farm scenery. Two solar farms originally filed for Huntington County abatement in December 2022. Paddlefish Solar of San Diego and Maple Solar of Charlotte, North Carolina. When approved, they were to comply with site development factors such as setbacks, land use, road maintenance and repair, drainage tile repair, and decommissioned ordinances. Also, it included inflationary adjustment and additional payments to the county if the power generation estimates increase. Next up, we have the article, City Leaders Question Architect, Town Official on Fire Station. This article by Alex Bracken, Miami County. New details have come to light in the town of Macy's Fire Station project. After Town Council President Marilyn Jackson, Architect Ed Kowalczyk of Jones Petry Rafinski, JPR, and Grant Administrator Stephen Ray appeared in front of the Miami County Commissioners at their meeting Monday, April 15th. Kowalczyk, who was the lead architect on the project, said the plans for the project changed four times. The initial plans, according to Kowalczyk, were drafted to be the Taj Mahal for grant application purposes, but they were later tapered down after he received guidance that the plans had to be more realistic. The project changed again while JPR was laying out the building and drafting their proposal and determined they would not be able to satisfy the full list of requests while staying in budget. After receiving a grant from the Office of Community and Rural Affairs, the architects began preparing a full design. Kowalczyk said that process includes a cost estimate, which revealed the project's plans were still over budget. After modifying the plans once again, the architects did another cost analysis, which revealed the project was still over budget. According to Kowalczyk, they searched for additional funding and arrived at a design they believed was biddable and sent it to bid. However, the two bids that came back were higher than expected, causing them to reduce the project even further, and resulted in them selecting 8 items that could be removed from the project. Commissioners confronted Kowalczyk and Jackson about being unaware of the changes, to which Kowalczyk said there were plenty of public meetings. "So we had several public meetings that were advertised, and we did display boards, and we presented what we were up against with the budget," Kowalczyk said. "But if we did not make the building smaller, there would be no building. There would be no project. The money was there, and that amount was all we had. So it was better than not having a building." Kowalczyk also responded to commissioners' concerns that the building was non-functional. "There are some areas that I think are very difficult to use, but they're not as difficult as the original building. The way JPR and the grant team saw it, it was still a large improvement. For the desired improvement, the dollars weren't there. We can't make $800,000 become $1.2 million," he said. One of the largest parts of the high cost for the building was the requirement to use Davis-Bacon wages, which was part of the conditions for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's grant. Those wages are generally more expensive and require more paperwork from contractors, which can increase cost. Fred Musselman, county commissioner, also asked Kowalczyk whether JPR had been paid around $6,000 to fix a water line at the new station. Kowalczyk said they had requested payment, but it had not yet been released. According to the architects, the line is used to fill water tanks from a well, but the style of pipe was changed to cut costs. Kowalczyk says he does not believe JPR is at fault for the design and should not need to incur the cost of rectifying the problem. He said that with the changes to the project and the limited budget, that JPR has paid for those design fees 5 or 6 times over. Marilyn Jackson, who oversaw the project for the town of Macy, said she takes responsibility for not communicating the changes. "Well, that's probably my fault. I didn't realize that we were obligated to come back with the design changes to all the funding sources. I didn't realize that. I take responsibility for not doing that," Jackson said. Corey Roser, County Planning and Zoning Administrator, also said during the meeting that a certificate of occupancy had not yet been issued. Kowalczyk told Roser he would be taking care of that as soon as possible. According to the Miami County Planning Department, the station had a few items which needed to be fixed before a certificate of occupancy could be issued. Kowalczyk also confirmed that JPR had asked for overages in the grant, which he said is not allowed to be returned back to the town. Since the design team was over budget, we asked if we could have that, and we were told yes. That has not been given to us. So the amount, just so you're aware, would not add square footage to that bay. It would add square inches to that bay, he said. Musselman questioned whether the overage could be used to purchase a shed to store equipment, which Kowalczyk said he would look into. Next up, on the April 26, 2024 edition of Wayndale News, we have the article, "Castleman's Return to Fort Wayne Trails." Kent Castleman, who served as the organization's executive director from 2016 to 2019, will return to the same position in early May. Castleman will collaborate with City of Fort Wayne, Allen County, and other municipal officials to advocate for Allen County's multi-purpose trail system, which spans more than 140 miles. Castleman is a seasoned nonprofit executive. Most recently, he served as chief philanthropy officer at the Embassy Theater and chief development officer at Lasting Change. Prior to his first term with Fort Wayne Trails, he was the founder and executive director of Cornerstone Youth Center. Castleman earned a bachelor's degree from Indiana University and is currently completing a Master of Arts in Philanthropic Studies from the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Castleman said he is excited to return to an organization he knows well. "Coming back to Fort Wayne Trails is a little like coming home," Castleman notes. "I know the staff and many of the elected officials, board members, volunteers, and donors, and I have tremendous respect for what they've accomplished in the last 5 years. I'm especially excited to collaborate with city and county government to continue the momentum they've generated." Fort Wayne Trails Board Chair Mike Kelly adds that Castleman is returning at a pivotal time for the organization. To cite just one example, Fort Wayne Trails is in the midst of the Connecting Four Capital Campaign, which strives to generate funding that will connect four priority corridor trail sections, one in each quadrant of the city, to the rest of the trail network. "There are some tremendously exciting projects and initiatives underway," Kelly explains, "and Kent is an ideal choice to lead the way. He'll hit the ground running from day one and help us do our part to continue to make our trail system a point of pride for Allen County." Castleman will be reintroduced to trails advocates at the Free to the Public Trek/Tread the Trails kickoff and Trails Celebration event at Promenade Park on Tuesday, April 30th. "We invite you all to join us in welcoming Kent back to the Trails family." Fort Wayne Trails, Inc. partners with communities throughout Allen County to promote the equitable development and maintenance of trails. To learn more about Fort Wayne Trails, visit fwtrails.org. Created in January 2011, Fort Wayne Trails, Inc. is a partner and advocate in the development of a connected multi-purpose trail system in Allen County, Indiana. There are currently over 142 miles of trails in our community. For more information or to donate, visit the organization's website, fwtrails.org, or contact us at 260-969-0079. Next up, we have the article, Protect Grant to Combat River Erosion in Wayndale Area. The city of Fort Wayne was awarded $3.5 million from the Federal Highway Administration Promoting Resilient Operations for Transformative, Efficient, and Cost-Saving Transportation, PROTECT, Discretionary Grant Program. Fort Wayne is the only PROTECT recipient in Indiana. The funding was awarded under four different grant types to 80 projects in 37 states, the District of Columbia, and the Virgin Islands. Fort Wayne's funding will be from the Resilience Improvement Grant awarded to only 36 communities nationwide, to be used to enhance the resilience of existing surface transportation infrastructure by improving drainage, relocating roadways, elevating bridges, or incorporating upgrades to allow infrastructure to meet or exceed design standards. The city of Fort Wayne will use the funding towards stabilizing 2,400 feet of the west bank of the St. Mary's River, utilizing nature-based solutions to prevent additional erosion that is threatening further damage to Bluffton Road. The road averages 23,400 vehicles daily, connects over 100 miles of pedestrian trails, and provides Wayndale and Fort Wayne residents with access to important cultural and economic hubs. "The erosion of the St. Mary's riverbank has been a long-standing issue," said Public Works Director Shan Gunawardena. "This funding provides a great opportunity to address a primary corridor, Bluffton Road, entering into the Wayndale area. Stabilizing the riverbank will help enhance the safety of this major corridor for years to come." Since 2014, the city has invested more than $340 million in neighborhood infrastructure enhancements. PBS Fort Wayne hosts open house. PBS Fort Wayne will have a community open house on Sunday, May 5th from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. at their station located at 2501 East Coliseum Boulevard, Fort Wayne, Indiana. During this event, attendees will have the opportunity to explore the station and get a behind-the-scenes perspective on what it takes to broadcast PBS Fort Wayne's five channels. In addition, those attending will also be able to take a tour of PBS Fort Wayne's production truck and studio. PBS Fort Wayne, PBS Fort Wayne staff will be on hand throughout the building to provide information and answer questions local viewers might have. The open house is free and open to people of all ages. Whether someone is a longtime viewer or simply curious about how the business of broadcasting works, PBS Fort Wayne will be the place to be on May 5th to learn more and explore. Carmelita's food truck, with lunch and dessert items available to purchase, will be available on-site in PBS Fort Wayne's parking lot for those wanting a bite to eat before or after touring PBS Fort Wayne. For more information about the open house, visit the station's webpage to learn more. This page will be updated regularly with details about parking for the event and directions on how to find PBS Fort Wayne. You may also contact PBS Fort Wayne with any questions you may have by phone at 260-484-8839. PBS Fort Wayne's mission is to enrich the community through engaging content. Established nearly 50 years ago, PBS Fort Wayne now operates as a public service media organization that harnesses a range of media tools to serve the community in new ways. With multiple broadcast channels, streaming, platforms, educational outreach, and engagement activities. Over its history, PBS Fort Wayne has been recognized for its innovation and creativity, with numerous awards, including regional Emmy Awards and National Telly Awards. Find more information at pbsfortwayne.org. PBS Fort Wayne also live streams its main channel, 39.1, to viewers in the Northeast Indiana region on its website, pbsfortwayne.org. On pbs.org, through the PBS app, and the PBS Fort Wayne app, Allen Media Group's Local Now digital platform, and since early November 2023, on Hulu Plus Live TV. Next up, we have the article, Sharon Tucker Wins Caucus, Becomes Fort Wayne Mayor. In a historic ceremony held on April 20th, Sharon Tucker was officially sworn in as the mayor of Fort Wayne, breaking new ground as the city's first African-American mayor. The event marks a significant milestone in Fort Wayne's history and ushers in a new era of leadership following the passing of longtime Mayor Tom Henry. The swearing-in ceremony, conducted by Carl Bandemer, was attended by numerous city officials, community leaders, and residents, all eager to witness this transformative moment in their city's governance. Tucker, who previously served as the executive director of Vincent House, Inc., and represented Fort Wayne's 6th District as a city councilwoman, steps into her new role with a wealth of experience in public service and community engagement. The transition has received strong endorsements from various quarters, including the Indiana Democratic Party and the Henry family, who have been longtime supporters of Tucker. The Henry family released a statement expressing their confidence in Tucker's leadership and their commitment to support her administration. Mike Schmull, chair of the Indiana Democratic Party, highlighted the significance of Tucker's election, stating, "Fort Wayne was incredibly blessed to have Mayor Henry's leadership for nearly 2 decades, and Mayor-elect Tucker will continue to lead the city in a positive direction." In her first address as mayor, Tucker expressed her dedication to continue the initiatives started by her predecessor while also paving new paths to meet the current needs of the community. She underscored her commitment to inclusivity, economic development, and public engagement. Among Tucker's notable initiatives is the founding of Project Activate Southeast Fort Wayne, PACE, P-A-S-E, a program designed to support local entrepreneurs and stimulate economic growth in underdeveloped areas of the city. She is also known for involvement in the Women in Politics Forum, an annual event aimed at empowering women in the political process. As Fort Wayne looks to its future under a new mayorship, community leaders remain optimistic about the positive changes Mayor Tucker is poised to bring. Her track record of active community involvement and her strategic vision for economic and social development are seen as key factors that will define her administration. Technically speaking, Tucker will not be the first female leader of Fort Wayne. In 1985, Fort Wayne experienced a unique moment in its political history when Cosette Simon briefly assumed the role of mayor, serving for just 11 days. Her short tenure as mayor was due to her stepping in as deputy mayor following the resignment of Mayor Winfield Moses, who had resigned to prepare for a special election. Moses was running to reclaim the mayoral office after having been convicted of a misdemeanor related to campaign finances. Despite the brief duration of her mayoral role, Simon's position was significant as it marked the first time a woman held the office in Fort Wayne's history. Her service, though temporary, highlighted the potential for women in leadership within the city and paved the way for future female candidates. Tucker was one of seven candidates trying for the position in the weeks following Henry's passing. The candidates presented their platforms to the 92 precinct chairs of the Allen County Democratic Party at Parkview Field, with the understanding that multiple rounds of voting might be necessary until one candidate secured over 50% of the vote. After just two rounds of voting, Tucker was informed by party leaders that she had been elected. Party Chair Derek Camp expressed confidence in Tucker's capabilities, citing her energy and dedication as key assets for the city's future. Looking ahead, Tucker will serve for about 3.5 years before potentially seeking election in her own right in 2027. She confirmed that current acting mayor Carl Bandemer will return to his role as deputy mayor, appreciating his desire to stay on and his extensive knowledge of ongoing projects. Despite not releasing the final vote counts, the Allen County Democratic Party noted Tucker's lead in both voting rounds. The initial round required 47 ballots for a win, resulting in the following vote distribution: Sharon Tucker, 38, Phil Giaquinta, 30, Stephanie Crandall, 10, Austin Knox, 9, Michelle Chambers, 3, Jorge Fernandez, 1, Palermo Galindo, 0. After the first round, Galindo and Fernandez were eliminated, and Chambers and Knox withdrew, leading to Tucker securing over 50% of the votes in the second round and clinching the victory. With a clear mandate and broad support, Mayor Sharon Tucker is set to lead Fort Wayne through a period of growth and transformation, ensuring that the city continues to thrive and reflect the values of its diverse population. Now moving on to the Bluffton News Banner. From the May 4th e-edition, we have the article, Bluffton Fire Department Has Some Big Shoes to Fill. Kelly Thompson retires after 39 years. This article by Jonathan Snyder. Kelly Thompson's 39-year tenure for the Bluffton Fire Department has come to an end, with his resignation letter turned in to the Bluffton Common Council on April 23rd. Thompson joined the BFD in 1985, making him the longest-tenured firefighter on the force before his resignation. Over those 39 years, Thompson has become a mentor to many firefighters who are still on the force and to those who have moved on. The department has gone through significant changes during Thompson's tenure. Much of the equipment that came through came from donated money. Thompson remembered the department's efforts in selling phone books and taking them throughout the city to get funding. From equipment to personnel, Thompson has seen the department grow exponentially. When I first started here, we had two frontline pumper trucks, and they were from 1962 and 1963, Thompson said. We went from a part-time chief to a full-time chief and assistant chief. A fire inspector, we got one of those. We had one back then, but it was part-time. It was just when the guy had time to do it. We had three drivers. Now we got 6 or 8. It's changed a lot. Thompson gleaned a lot of knowledge from his 39-year tenure, which he's always enjoying passing down to others. Battalion Chief Brandon Meckling, who worked with Thompson for 25 years, lauded Thompson's knowledge of cars and how to extract people from wrecked vehicles. Meckling remembered one time when the team had to improvise to retrieve someone from a vehicle impact. Meckling said Thompson's adaptability and knowledge of vehicles made the rescue a much easier process. He could look at the whole picture and just mechanically know, if we pry here, we cut here, we do this, do that, we can get inside, Meckling said. He can see the overall picture and is very helpful on giving suggestions or advice like, hey, have we thought about it this way or thought about it that way? T- Thompson has a knack for mentoring the younger guys, according to Fire Chief Don Craig and Deputy Fire Chief Chris Wolf, both of whom came on after Thompson and Meckling. Thompson emphasized showing up to training sessions and sharing his knowledge with others. That was always a good trait about Kelly. Kelly would always share what he knew or what he learned, Wolf said. That's just Kelly. Kelly can make a friend with a tree. Craig recalled Thompson training him on driving a grass rig with a boat trailer attached behind it. Craig said he was apprehensive about driving it because he had little experience with a trailer at the time. Kelly grabbed me and said, "Jump in." And you know, I'm kind of stammering, but Thompson says, "You got this." So he jumped in the passenger seat. I jumped in the driver's seat and we started moving, Craig remembered. Kelly just looks at me and says, "Calm down. You're in a parking lot. It's not an emergency. Just calm down and drive the thing like you would your own vehicle." Thompson would do that at driver's training. He'd do that in a fire. He does that in education. He would sit there and he would coach and mentor, Wolf added. Thompson would think, "Man, instead of me grabbing the tool, instead of me getting behind the wheel and doing this, how about you do it?" And then we both feel good when we leave. He was more of a giver than a taker. I always try to include a new one or two of them or three firefighters. I always try to include them because they don't learn if we don't tell them, Thompson said. I want to make them more forward where they feel like, hey, I know how to do that. So they don't have to ask and don't feel like, I wish Thompson was here. I don't want them to feel that way. Thompson was also extremely dedicated to the department. Meckling notes that many other guys have only lasted about 2 or 3 years in the department. Craig admires that no matter what was going on in Thompson's life, Thompson was vigilant. The fact that he stayed on the fire service in spite of catastrophic events that happened in his own personal life, Craig said, to put that aside and still want to be in this community helping others, says a lot about Kelly. Sometimes you get new firefighters saying, it's neat, and they'll be on it for 2 years and then they're done, Meckling said. Then you can see a guy that's been doing it for almost 40 years. I think it just serves as a good reminder that, you know, we're doing good for the community and that there's a reward at the end of it. Kelly's absence will be sorely missed, Wolf said. In his retirement, Thompson plans to continue restoring a group of old motorcycles and enjoy time with his grandchildren. Throughout his tenure, Thompson understood the need to be a mentor and friend to others. You can't fill those shoes, Wolf said. I mean, that is how he was raised. And you know, when you work with somebody that many years, his departure, it's just different. Training is probably my biggest thing. I liked it, Thompson said. I was a firm believer that these old guys need to show up and be in training. You gotta be persistent about it because these little guys are looking up to you. And they're looking and seeing what you're doing. You can't be good enough to the new ones. In his departure, Thompson had nothing but praise for the Bluffton Fire Department and the current team working there. The friendships he's built and the people he helped mentor still carry the torch he helped spark. The group that I'm working with now probably are some of the best I've worked with, Thompson said. They're more receptive to new people. We have always had a good group of guys. They were workers, and they always had your back. And with that, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Alexander with Area News. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service of the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.